Okay, hello everybody. Welcome. I almost said good afternoon, but I realize that that's irrelevant for many of you anyway. But it's afternoon here. It's a sunny day in Ojai. Everything is everything, as they used to say. And I'm happy to be here with you. I'm going to start with a couple of emails. Dear John, I am still continuing the practice, and if you could guide me here, of late when I ask myself if I am here and what that means, I feel a sensation in my body that's difficult to describe. It's like a tingling sensation, but without the tingling. Does this mean anything? The best I can come up with is that it feels like an awareness of myself from the inside. Am I making progress? Well, here's the thing. Whatever you're doing in an effort to have the direct, immediate, face-to-face contact with the reality of what you are, whatever you're doing and whatever internal experiences arise in the course of doing that, well, the internal experiences that arise in the course of doing that are actually irrelevant. They are a distraction. There's no... The reality of what you are is actually not an experience at all. The reality of what you are is the ground of all experience and all experiencing. Here's the thing. The inquiry is a one-step process. It's step one. Try with all your heart to get a direct, immediate, unmediated, ununderstood, unnameable contact with the reality of what you are. There is no step two. The experiences that come and go around this effort to bring yourself in direct connection with yourself are beside the point. They can be distracting, by which I mean that you can choose to put your attention on those experiences or not, but they are beside the point of the inquiry. No experience that results from the inquiry is the object of the inquiry. The inquiry is nothing but to bring yourself in contact with yourself. The fact that you write to me and the fact that you're doing this in the way that you're doing it is an indication that you're doing it right. None of the experiences that surround it and none of your opinions about what they mean or do not mean have any relevance to whether you're doing it right. Tingling sensation, no tingling. When there's a sensation of tingling without tingling, which is an interesting concept, when there is the sensation of tingling without tingling, there is also the presence of the one who is experiencing the sensation. The only thing that matters is to turn your attention inward to the one who is the experiencer of these sensations. That will bring you home. Okay, another one. Nice going, John. One question. In all the videos from Gangaji and you that I've watched, not once I've heard the name Jay Krishnamurti mentioned. Another thing I want to bring up, how can one be sure that this concept of when everything else is removed, the only thing that's left is the true self, how can one be sure of this? It could be just another trick of the mind. if I stop competing, I can't lose anymore, for example. And then there's the fact that when one doesn't take everyday life so seriously anymore, after all, it isn't really got anything to do with the real me. How about the horror that's happening in the world? With horror in the world, I not only mean people torturing and killing each other, but also the fact that there are people who will never have the chance of ever discovering their true self, like people with brain damage and so on, not to mention cancer, etc. And this is all contained in this beautiful source that is really me, us. Now, one could say it's only my confused, egoistic mind, which is trying to keep me from turning my back on it, which is telling me these things. But again, can you show me it isn't telling me and make me feel, believe this concept of the true self? Wow. Okay, beginning at the beginning. I can't speak for Gangaji. I have no idea why she says or doesn't say anything she says or doesn't say. I don't have much to say about why I don't mention Jay Krishnamurti, except for the fact that Jay Krishnamurti is dead and gone, along with Ramana and the Buddha, Nisargadatta, and many, many other examples of humans who have seen what's real. I will say this about Jay Krishnamurti, and that is that he was, when I was caught in the fever of spiritual melodrama, when I read about him and his history with the Theosophical Society and his history with all of that, he actually became kind of a hero for me, not because of anything he said, because actually his expression was extremely philosophical and intellectual. So not because of anything he said or anything he taught, but because of the audacity with which he rejected the role that the Theosophists had carved out for him, which was to be a world savior. They discovered this young boy in India, and the details escape me right now, but that they groomed him and sent him to school and sent him to Oxford and had in mind for him that they had discovered a world savior who would bring salvation and peace and understanding to the world. Krishnamurti at some point when the time came actually for him to assume this role, rejected it and said it was ridiculous. And his willingness to turn his back, his audacity to turn his back on this calling to be something special, something other than human, made him for me a kind of a hero, a kind of a hero. I don't actually talk about many of the things that the great ones have said, except in passing. I don't even talk much about the things that Ramana, who is very much the source of the insight which broke the fever for me. I don't really talk much about anything that he said either, because you see, the issue is not what all of these great ones said. The issue is what you see. The issue is you. It's always you. It has nothing to do with anything that's gone before. Nothing whatsoever. So I don't see much point in speaking or commenting on the utterances of spiritual teachers and great beings in the past. As to how one can be sure that the concept of when everything else is removed, the only thing that's left is the true self, I can only assume that what you're speaking about here is what I have said in the past about the efficacy and the usefulness of the question, who am I, which is if you, in any circumstance whatsoever, for example, the circumstance of the tingling that is not, it doesn't have a tingle to it, in any circumstance, in any set of experience whatsoever, there is an I that is presumed to be the subject of these things, and the whom of that is a direction in which we can easily turn our attention, since the one who seems to be the subject, either the beneficiary or the victim of arising experience, is so present, the more powerful the experience, the more powerful the sense of someone being the subject of it. And that's the question, who am I? That is the purpose of the question, who am I? To bring attention to the entity that seems to be so real here, that seems to be so much the subject of everything that passes through, in order that, as Ramana always pointed out, if attention is brought to that entity, it will, the sense and the presence of that entity will disappear. In the absence of that, what remains is reality. I never speak about, or if I do, I misspeak when I do so. I try never to speak about true self, since the distinction between true and false self is absurd. There is only self, and even self is a concept that's unnecessary here. The point of the question, who am I, is not to even discover that the one you believe yourself to be is inexistent, since in the moment following the discovery of that, the one you believe yourself to be will arise again like the phoenix from the ashes and be doing quite well within a couple of seconds. The point of the question, who am I, is to have a moment of absence of this feeling that I am something here, something palpable here that's affected by ongoing experience, so that, not so that you can or find out what your true self is, but so that in the absence of that obscuration, that distraction, that feeling of me, just for a second, the light of reality shines unobstructed in your mind. Unseen, unnoticed, unseeable, but unobstructed, this light shines in your mind. And it's that light that does the work of the inquiry. Everything about the inquiry, whether it's an inquiry into, am I here, or an inquiry into, who am I, everything about the inquiry has but one purpose, and that is to allow the light of reality to flood the mind. Because it's that light that does the work of destroying the lie that you are this life alone, that there's nothing to you but this life. So it matters not at all whether you come to believe in the concept that what remains when all else vanishes is reality. It doesn't matter at all that you believe what remains is true self. The only thing that matters is that momentary opening of the contracted and limited and constricted apparatus of human consciousness to the light of reality. Anything that brings that about is self-inquiry or self-seeking. And as far as the horror in the world, not only mean people torturing and killing each other, well, I can tell you this, that when the light of reality floods the mind of every human being on the planet, the torturing and killing will come to an end. I promise you that. As the torturing and killing that is our normal activity day to day in relationship to our own lives, as we try to punish our wrongdoing and do away with our bad thoughts and our negativity and our aggression and so forth, that those acts of warfare, the attempts to destroy aggression and negativity, those acts of warfare come to an end. And when those acts of warfare come to an end, so too do the acts of warfare that are externally directed. We have, as I have said, a gazillion times, we have in the course of human history tried everything that we could possibly imagine and think of to try to bring an end to the horror and the killing and the torturing of each other by each other. And nothing we tried works. This works. As to the fact that there are people who will never have the chance of ever discovering their true self, like people with brain damage and so on, not to mention cancer, no one has to discover their true self. There is no true self. There is no false self. There is only you. Only you. There's nothing else to be found anywhere. And whether you see yourself through the limitation of normal human stupidity, or see yourself through the limitation of brain damage or other horrors that things that seem horrible that can affect the human physical body or the human mental body, no matter what form of limitation you see yourself through, the actuality of you is never absent. The actuality of you is absolutely present. And no one is ever apart from that, no matter what the state of the physical body, no matter what the state of the mental body. The reality is here. The confusion comes from the conviction that is itself founded in the profound, unseen conviction of that I am this life alone, that there's nothing to me but this life, and that I am at stake here, and that what I do right and what I do wrong is what will determine whether I am good or bad or saved or not saved or whatever. That conviction, that belief, is what gives rise to the certainty that enlightenment means enlightenment of this human being. Enlightenment and realization means a transformation of the human intelligence and the human consciousness and the human apparatus, the apparatus of personality and limitation. The truth is it has nothing to do with that. The truth is that there is nothing whatsoever that comes from exposure to reality that will transform the human limitation, whether it's the normal, everyday limitation of human small-mindedness and pettiness and stupidity and aggression and so forth, or the extraordinary limitation that comes from physical disability. The purpose of the investigation, the purpose of everything we do in this realm of self-seeking has nothing to do with transforming the apparatus. So the state of the apparatus to begin with is actually beside the point. It may be that no one can tell who is more able in any given moment of being finished with any lie that I am this life alone. There's nothing about sickness or disease or health or well-being or any of those things that are an accurate predictor of the possibility of being finished with the lie. Disease. Yes, all is contained. It's not the fact that all is contained within reality is not something to believe or disbelieve. It is a self-evident actuality. And as to whether it is the confused, egoistic mind which is trying to keep me from turning my back on it, which turning my back on the horror of life, the confusion and the difficulties of life and so forth, nothing about this teaching, nothing about this offer of the possibility to be finished with misery and suffering, fearfulness and anxiety, involve turning one's back on anything. This is, again, has to do with the conviction that we are these lies, has to do with the conviction that something must be done about the normally perverse way in which these lives unfold and in which this consciousness plays in human beings. The idea that there's a need to turn your back on life is itself a part of the lie that this life is what you are and nothing else. No one asks you to do that. And he asks again, can you show me that it's not simply my egoistic mind telling me and making me believe the concept of the true self, too? Anything that you believe, anything that you think, anything that you are convinced you know is part of the apparatus of the life, the apparatus of human existence. Anything, whether it's the good feelings that come with the idea of true self or the bad feelings that come with the idea that I will never realize true self, it is all part and parcel of this apparatus that defines you as a person, that is the shape and structure and contour of the personality. None of it has any relevance to the seeking and totally including true self. None of it has any relevance to the extraordinarily intimate and incommunicable effort to come face to face with reality. Nothing. Reality is not true self. Reality is nothing about which anything can be said or believed or disbelieved. And then this person goes on, but what good is it to be negative about something that's a good thing? Even if the mind is also making the story of the self up, it's better to pursue a nice goal than a bad one, right? Not really. It's neither good or bad to pursue goals. To be honest, I had a taste of the divine too, and still have the echo of that in me. Reading and listening to your words and those of Gangaji, Krishnamurti, Ramana, etc., do bring up good, loving feelings. So really, I should just throw out my negative comments and accept my best wishes. None of this has anything to do with self-seeking. None of this has anything to do with the investigation, with the effort to have the direct contact with reality. Good feelings, bad feelings, they are the same. They are part of the apparatus of the personality, the apparatus of the life shape, the life shape that needs no correction, that needs nothing to be done about it. It is not the problem. The shape of the life, the nature of the life, the presence of good feelings, the presence of bad feelings, none of these things has anything to do whatsoever with the effort to come in contact with reality. These things that are the shape of the life, that are the apparatus whereby the shape of the life takes form and plays in the world, these things are utterly, absolutely, and totally beside the point. So too is the inclination to indulge in these things. That too needs nothing done about it. So too is the inclination to despise these things. That too needs nothing to be done about it. We have tried with all of our hearts for thousands of years to do something about these things to no avail. All that ever needs to be done is to try with all your heart to make whatever effort you can possibly bring to bear to the desire to be face-to-face with reality without regard to the fact that face-to-face with reality, nothing is seen. Nothing. Nothing has changed. Okay, one more email. When the intention for self-inquiry arises, it is known that self is that intention and nothing needs to be done. At other times, it's like there is nothing there and life continues in my absence. It's of no consequence. First of all, I'm going to try to speak to this as I go along. First of all, it's of no import whatsoever, the insight that self is the intention itself and nothing needs to be done. These things are understandings and insights that come and go, and some of them are sweet and kind of thrilling, and others of them are dull and not very interesting at all. They are beside the point. They are opportunities to be distracted. They are not bad. Even distraction is not bad. Being called into the conundrums and the paradoxes that seem to play whenever we start turning our attention to matters other than the spiritual matters. These things are opportunities to be distracted, and it's perfectly all right to be distracted by them, but they are absolutely beside the point to the investigation, to the effort itself. So he goes on, still working on this and even more confused. Often on inquiry, there is the cessation of thought, and sometimes thoughts happening with no more attention given than to, say, breathing. Should this silence be chosen when the choice arises? And then there can be no active choice to do any action of inquiry. Or should I desire to develop curiosity into what is experiencing this silence? I am not sure whether this silence is an object that can be experienced, in which case that inquiry may be possible, or if the silence is the subject through which all thoughts and sensations about a concept of I and all consequent ideas happens. This whole confusion, this whole reflection on the arising of silence, the question as to whether silence is something that should be sought, or whether the desire to investigate should be sought, the question whether silence is an object that can be experienced, this whole thing, and especially as it revolves around silence and its role in these things, is again commentary. It's internal commentary on, well, nothing really. It's internal commentary on the ideas and understandings that come and go within me about the way in which the mind ebbs and flows, changes, shifts. The mind, after all, is the original shapeshifter. It can be silent, it can be noisy, it can be quizzical, it can be curious, it can be all kinds of things. That conversation is beside the point to the effort to bring attention directly to the reality of what you are. And that effort to bring attention directly to the reality of what you are operates without regard to this commentary that goes on about it. Whenever it's possible for you for just a moment to turn attention away from this discussion that's going on, simply do this. Simply see if you cannot have directly the immediate, direct meeting with the reality of what you are. Now, the reality of what you are is neither silence nor noise. It is neither an object nor not an object. The reality of what you are cannot in any way whatsoever be described or defined or understood within the context of the human mind. The purpose of the investigation, the purpose of the seeking after self, is not to gain a new understanding of what you are. The whole commentary that makes up your inner mental life since it began is an effort to understand what you are. The inquiry is not an effort to understand what you are. It's an effort to open the mind just for a second to the light of reality, which cannot be seen, about which nothing can be done. The purpose of this is to gradually, over time, rid yourself of the fundamental assumption that there's nothing to you but this life. And in the absence of that fundamental assumption, to be free of the undercurrent of fearfulness and anxiety that make us all worry about whether we're doing it right or doing it wrong, or whether it means this or that or the other thing. All that ever has to be done is, whenever it occurs to you to do so, stop for just 1 second and make that effort. And if that is unsatisfactory to you, then make the effort to find the one for whom it is unsatisfactory. Not to understand it, not to know it for what it is, just to see it. This is all there is to be done. The rest of this is of no consequence. You know, it's beside the point. It's not beside the point and of no consequence within the human mind. Nothing needs to be done about it, this quest for understanding and so forth. It's just beside the point to this that I am offering, which is the possibility to make the effort to see yourself directly without the mediation of understanding. And my claim that this effort itself is all that's ever needed. It will bring you home. It will bring an end to misery and suffering. And then the email goes on, self-inquiry consistently highlights I am, but there is nothing more I can do. What is prior to I am cannot be known as any process, just adds something at the end of the I am. It seems all inquiry is pointless. If the dissolution of the I is possible, it must be by a grace that is beyond manipulation. We are not seeking the dissolution of the I here. We are not seeking any result that is reflected within the life shape, the apparatus, the structure, and the architecture of the human mind. We are seeking to dissolve nothing nor to make anything concrete. We are seeking only the light of awareness, which is invisible, and which is the reality of what you are, And we are seeking it not in order that we can understand ourselves to be that light, because we already know that. We are seeking contact with the light of awareness in order that the light of awareness can rid us of the lie. And that happens without regard to anything we think about it, to any of our opinions about its usefulness or lack of usefulness. If the effort is made, the lie will be gone. The light of awareness will do the work. Despite all of our conviction or opinions or ideas, pro or con. Grace is already here. Grace is always here. Grace is never absent. It is grace, the arising of the effort to make, to come in contact with reality, that is grace. Ramana told someone who spoke about the necessity of God's grace and how nothing else mattered but God's grace. Ramana responded to that once by saying, "Why should God bestow grace upon one who doesn't make the effort to find it?" So, I hope this is helpful. And lastly, before I turn this whole thing over to you guys, I had a very interesting meeting the other day here with a man who had come to one meeting, a physical meeting, had come to one meeting with me and who had written to me in what I thought to be an offer to help me communicate more clearly what it is I'm trying to communicate. And after a couple of emails passed, I met with this gentleman in person and found that, and I have to say that I really don't think that I was very useful or very helpful to this person. I was inexperienced in a context like the one I found myself in, and I didn't do very well with actually hearing what was being said or what was underneath being said. But nevertheless, the subject of it was of some interest, because it seemed to me, and again, I don't know whether you're here or not. If you are, please feel free to correct me if I misstate what happened. But the thrust of it, and the thing that makes it interesting to me in this context, is that it's the first time really that I have been directly challenged about my disdain for spiritual utterance. At least that's the way it felt to me. It seemed to me that this guy, I know that he has a great deal of experience in spiritual matters, in spiritual practice, in spiritual pilgrimage, and so forth, and also has a great deal of understanding and experience with spiritual utterance and spiritual writings. And what he seemed to be saying to me, and this is the best I can do, what he seemed to be saying to me was that because I speak to people as if they are exactly the same as me, as if there is no difference between the people with whom I speak and myself, that because of that, the usefulness and the power of what it is that I am trying to convey cannot be conveyed. And that what I really needed to do was to speak to people from what it has been called in some writings the absolute, and to identify that that's the standpoint from which I am speaking, I think, so that those who hear me will understand that there's something being said here that is of greater import than the normal discourse that passes between human beings, even in a spiritual context or even in a context as highfalutin as this one. That's what seems to me to be the case, that I was being asked or that I was being offered the opportunity to see. And that, and he spoke in particular about Nisargadatta, who Nisargadatta is, of course, he's a dead guy, right? So it's really hard for us to know what Nisargadatta might or might not say about anything in particular. What we have of Nisargadatta's teachings, just as what we have of Ramana's teachings and Milarepa's teachings and Padmasambhava and the Buddha's teachings, for that matter, what we have of them are written words written by other people or transcribed transcriptions of meetings and utterances by these people, and which makes it a little more difficult to be for consideration of these things to be useful to us, since it's quite obvious and quite clear that, to me, that just as it is, no matter how hard I try, I can never say what it is I want to say to you. No matter how hard I try, as the vocal thought arises in this form, it comes to you through the limitations and the confusion of this form. And the same is true for Nisargadatta. The same is true for Ramana. And the same is true for all. It is my sense, and it's my deep, deep realization that all speech arises from the Absolute, that there is no difference between the source of the speech that arises from you and the source of the speech that arises from me. It is only the Absolute from which all things come and go. I don't even like the word the Absolute. It's a word that seems to ring so true and seems to be so powerful and so fundamental, but really it's just a word. And the spiritual utterance itself always arises from the same place as does political utterance or financial utterance or dishwashing utterance or any other utterance, from this same fount of shifting expression and manifestation, this same background. The thing about spiritual utterance, and especially about utterance in which, whether by implication or by direct assertion, the speaker is said to be speaking from a place truer than the place that you speak from, is that these ideas have great power. They are very beautiful. They are they're the most beautiful speech. The most beautiful, the most powerful utterance comes from this desire to say something true about reality, this desire to bring something to the rest of humanity about reality, to bring the key to the rest of the world about how to be free of misery and suffering, of fearfulness and anxiety. And since they arise from that impulse and that intention, they almost always, without exception, take on a power and a beauty and a gorgeousness that makes them stand apart from everyday mundane speech. And it's precisely because of that that they present such difficulty in the spiritual mind. It is precisely their power and beauty that it's through their power and beauty that they call attention to themselves rather than to the reality they purport to point to. It's precisely their power and beauty that make them such compelling distractions from the only thing that confirms them, which is the effort in each individual human mind to come face to face with reality. They become the distraction, actually, from the reality they seek to evoke, and they call us away from this seeking after ourself, which is all that can be done. Seeking after the direct contact with reality, which is all that needs to be done. You see, this is very important. It is the seeking, and you know, this business of seeking is the problem. Seeking needs to be done away with. Calling off the search. All of these kind of catchphrases that we've taken so seriously all this time, to no good avail. I mean, here we are, still in the same boat we were 5,000 years ago. And these ideas are reflective of an outcome, an end to the search, an end to the seeking. But until the actual purpose of the seeking is had, it is the seeking itself that does the work. Not seeking enlightenment, although that's okay, it can't hurt you. Not seeking peace and fulfillment, although that's okay too, it really can't hurt you. Can't help you, can't hurt you. Not seeking the dissolution of the I, that's okay too. Can't do anything to hurt you or help you. But seeking reality, here and now, in this moment, reality, seeking the certainty that I am. That's the reality. Seeking the face-to-face contact, the meeting with reality, with the light of awareness. Not in order to become the light of awareness, not in order to understand the light of awareness, not in order even to see the light of awareness, since light is, after all, invisible. Seeking only to face it. And it is the facing of that. And everything I'm saying, every word that I have uttered, and every word that I will utter has nothing whatsoever to do, does not describe or explain or understand or teach a belief about reality. Nothing I say is reality, but it is that seeking that does the work. The seeking, the direct meeting with reality, that's what does the work. It is, in the end, the seeking after self, the seeking of the direct, immediate, face-to-face contact with self. The only point in calling it self is because if you look for self, you will absolutely come in contact with reality. It's not because self is true self or not true self. It's not because it is self that is the enlightenment. It is because as it happens, the seeking after self brings us in contact with the light of reality. So, once again, step-by-step instructions. I also had a guy write to me and ask me for step-by-step instructions. And he asked me, what about God Almighty? What about the miracles of Milarepa? What about that stuff? God Almighty is beside the point. I could tell you that it's all God Almighty, but of what use is that to you? None. The miracles of Milarepa. You know, Milarepa was this guy who, he was a student. He's a really well-known and profoundly powerful teacher within the Kagyu lineage of the Tibetan Buddhist world. His teacher was Marpa, and prior to his finding of his teacher and following the instructions of his teacher, which I'll tell you briefly in a minute, prior to that, he was a black sorcerer and killed people and caused a great deal of damage in the world with his black magic. When he found Marpa, who ended up to be his teacher, he was put through a course of action that involved the building one stone at a time with his bare hands of huge, tall stone towers, each one of which he was then required by Milarepa to tear down and put the stones back where they came from and then go to another place and build the same stone tower with a new set of stones. He did this three times before finally he, I guess, got tired of doing that and found peace. As to the step-by-step instructions, once again, here it is. Step one, try with all your heart to see yourself. Try with all your heart to see yourself without understanding, without knowing, without anything whatsoever except the naked seeing. That's step one. There is no step two. So, if you want to talk to me, I guess you know how to do that, so I'll wait. Thank you for your attention.
Travis is calling from San Francisco.
Hi, Travis.
Hi, John. Thank you again so much, John, for your very simple offering. I especially like this time around the intricate step-by-step instructions. I really appreciate that.
I'm glad I could be of help.
I wanted to share with you some news from my life and sort of a report that I think, I don't know if it resulted from it, but kind of came around it. Since the last time we spoke, on April 9th, my mother became very ill. She couldn't get out of her couch or her bed in the morning, and I got a call from her caretaker. She wasn't able to let her caretaker in, and I drove over there and I found her. She wasn't really able to speak. She was fighting for breath. She has years and years and years of health problems, and she said a few words to each other, but we got her to the emergency room. She lost consciousness, and a few days later she had a heart attack, and then they were able to resuscitate her, but a few days after that, we had to decide to, as per her wishes, to cut off the life support, and she passed away on the 14th. When I found her at first, she's a little fist balled up, and she's a small woman. Well, she was a short woman. She was a big woman, but she was a short woman. Little fist balled up, fighting for breath, when she saw who it was that was looking down at her, she said, finish it. She said that twice. And I told her I would do what needed to be done, but that first we were going to try the hospital, and she kind of nodded to me and went back to fighting for breath. Without having found or come back to the teaching of Ramana Maharshi a year ago via you and YouTube, I don't think I would have been able to fulfill my mother's wishes. I feel very blessed by my mother that she, for years, we had talked about what should happen if she got into certain medical conditions and circumstances and how long to try for life support and the general conditions under which to give up that effort. And so I don't feel any doubt that what I did was, and the steps that I took right along the way were the right thing to do. But I would not have been able to be clear of this without having really spent time whenever I could just looking at what I really am. And one of the things that I find blessed by, or feel blessed by in this whole experience is that, as you say, and as has been my experience, that once the self-inquiry starts, it does itself. And my mother, as she got older and older and her health declined, for years I would see her once to three times a week and shop for her and help clean up and everything and take care of her. But we would have these wonderful conversations about life and about the things she had taught me. And a few months back we had a conversation and I just shared with her what I had been going through. And I just saw in that moment, I saw her really take a look at herself. And I saw the self-inquiry start. She wasn't ever able, she wasn't very disciplined about it. She did it her own way, which is what she did everything in her life. But I know that had begun for her. What happened was when she was sick and in the hospital and dying, the Friday before she passed away, I was doing my morning meditation routine like I do every day. And I had an image of her come up in me and in my mind, and I felt a great sadness. But then I realized that my vision of my mother was stopping at her body, was stopping at the flesh that composed her body-mind, form. And for me, months ago, I think at some point, I don't know when it happened, but I stopped that identification for myself, and it gave a great peace to me for myself. But until that day, I was still identifying everybody else as the face they presented to the world. And that dropped away, and I looked at my mother as she really is. And although I miss her greatly, and we'll go through continuing to take care of the rest of her wishes as far as her estate's concerned and her remains. I know that what she really, really is hasn't gone anywhere. And for that, I feel incredibly blessed, and I wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, boy, well, you're very welcome. This is this is such good news. Thank you so much for this report, Travis. You're very welcome. Anything else?
Well, there's all kinds of stories I could say around it, I guess, but I don't think that just doesn't make much sense right now. But I guess that's it for today. Thank you, John, and thank you, Carla, for your efforts.
Oh, you're very welcome. You know, it is really true that your report and really, it's breathtaking that you were able to see the inquiry begin in your mother. It is absolutely breathtaking to me. It actually kind of choked me up. I don't remember what I was going to say, except that I'm very happy to hear this. The fact is that what you have seen as the impulse to see others as limited to the faces and the bodies and the forms that are presented to you. And of course, that's not something, as you must know, that's not something that comes as a result of understanding it or figuring it out or getting the insight of it. That's something just like the dropping away of the continual conviction that you are nothing more than your life. That happened all on its own. It's not something that could, it's not that that can be sought after. Just as it's not the dropping away of the conviction that others are although you are not, others are those bodies, those faces, those, the way they speak and so forth, that comes to you from what they appear to be. That is, of course, the actual fact of the matter. The actual fact of the matter is that the spiritual utterances about there is no other are true. They are just way more true than the words that express them can possibly contain. And as that feeling of distance and so forth between you and others falls away, then you see that it actually is the case that we are in this together. It actually is the case that there is not the slightest hint of any separation or distance or difference at all between you and me, between the being that was Nisargadatta and you, between your mother and you, between anybody and you. And it is that, the revealing of that, and it's not like that's a new thing. It is revealing what we have always seen to be the case. You know, all of this is the revealing of what is already present. But it is the revealing of that makes it possible for true compassion to be revealed as well. True compassion, which is the knowing that I am the same as you. You are the same as me. That there is nothing to separate us. That there is no difference between us. That the differences are all the play of the light of awareness, as it, which perhaps has no purpose other than to see itself, to express itself. And this is a great thing. Your mother has given you a great gift in this. So thank you so much, Travis, for this report. See you later.
I wanted to cut back in there. I don't mean to double dip, but I just wanted to say that I absolutely get what you mean, and that there's no switches I can throw or that tell somebody else to throw or steps to take to come to that scene of my mother. But the only switch that can be thrown is to actually do the inquiry and to look at what's real. And I don't know how that new vision of my mother came up. It's not a new vision. It's the vision that was always there that I just wasn't looking at. It's the truth of the situation. And nothing we can do can make the truth happen because it's already happening. I just wanted to say back to something you said earlier about you were talking about the words that people use and the talking from a place of authority. That's my take on it, that you were mentioning, that this other person mentioned to you. And it brought to mind, to me, Yuji Krishnamurti, who I hold up as an example of attaining realization doesn't make you, if you're a jerk and you attain realization, you're still a jerk. Yuji Krishnamurti was kind of a jerk, but he was also very sweet in his communication with people. I think that he just was very ruthless in his way of talking with people. And the one thing he would often say is, if there's a difference between you and me, it's only that I don't see a difference between you and me. And that was sort of something that he repeated quite often. You know, why would you come to me for help when there's no difference between us? And then just to mention about the gift from my mom, I guess I am going to tell the story. One of my heroes of Zen has been Bunkai. And the story of Bunkai, in a nutshell, is that he was very devoted to his mother, and he went to great lengths, did great amounts of effort to try and enlighten himself, as you know, even going up to meditating while sitting on sharp rocks and dunking ice water over his head in this unending quest to get enlightenment so that he could give it to his mother. And his mother was very sickly, and finally he got very, very sick from what he was doing. And it was only when he was on his deathbed that he let go of the effort and really suddenly sat up. The story goes he suddenly sat up in bed and hacked up a great deal of the gunk that was in his lungs from the infection that he had got, and then was able to breathe again and sort of came to this place of realizing that the self process, the unborn mind is going to deal with anything regardless of what we do, so it just let it happen. And he attained this realization, and then he raced, after nursing himself back to health, to his mother's bedside. She was dying, and he spoke to her a few words, and she was liberated, so the story goes, before she passed away. And for a long time in my personal quest, this is what I wanted. I wanted to be Bunkai. I wanted to give that to my mother. And my mother passed away, and when she did, as that process happened, when I had that realization about her, I realized that that she had done that to me, that my mother was Bunkai, and that her efforts and her gift of how she lived her life is what allowed me to see the truth of what she really was, and not the reverse as I had hoped it would be.
That's excellent. That's very good. Thank you, Travis. Very pleased with this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Anybody else?
We have Brett calling from Orinda, California.
Brett, hi.
Hey, John.
What can I do for you, my friend?
Well, I just, this is such a beautiful meeting, and I guess I couldn't hold back any longer saying why I appreciate your particular teaching so much. And I think that it's come out a bit in this satsang in particular, which is for the longest time I've noticed that the majority of teachings, I'd say, I don't know if you want to put a percentage on it, but say 99% of the teachings is a subtle description of who we are. And it's very subtle. I mean, for the longest time I would read, you know, Ramana, and, you know, when he speaks of the self, even that's a description. And when I hear you speak, it's so refreshing because finally there's not a description of who I am, who we are. It's just a looking toward that which is, you know. It's hard for me even to describe that, but I see often, you know, the struggle, not that you struggle with it, but the sort of dilemma that you have with a great deal of questions, which it's almost as if we're asking for more descriptions about ourselves from you, whereas you're so steadfast in not offering that, you know, and it's really beautiful. And I've had such a tremendous shift because of that, you know, because when there's a craving for some experience or some description, very, very subtle, you know, it gets very subtle the more spiritual you get, of course. But then, you know, constantly just look at what is here, you know. So I just wanted to put that out, especially in the context of this satsang and the couple of questions, emails that you read, and I really enjoyed how you replied with those.
Well, I can't tell you how tickled I am to hear this, Brett. It's because it must mean that at least in some regards, what I'm trying to do is getting through, because you're absolutely right. I think it's much higher percentage than that. I think that pretty much all spiritual utterance is description, and pretty much all of the efforts to bring people to realization are devolved eventually into description. Some, as you see and point out, extremely nuanced and extremely subtle, but all description, all presenting competing versions of what it is that we should be, what it is that we should believe ourselves to be. Whereas the actuality, of course, is that there is nothing that we can believe ourselves to be that is real, that there is no identity whatsoever that is actual, and that every attempt on the part of human consciousness to come to a definition and description of itself in order that it can be satisfied and fulfilled with itself is doomed to be the cause of more misery and suffering, more fearfulness and anxiety. The only possibility, the only hope, is to find some way to bring attention directly to reality itself, without regard to, even the word reality is descriptive. There is nothing whatsoever that can be said through this form, through this personal apparatus, that is true. Nothing. And that's why it is, that's why it seems so excruciatingly difficult to say what it is that I really want to say to you and to everybody, which is, step one, do everything you can possibly think of to try to get a direct, immediate contact with the real. And there is no step two. Everything else is taken care of. And all of the descriptions and all of the nuances and all of the subtlety and all of the beauty, the real beauty and power of these spiritual concepts and spiritual ideas are distractions from that until they are seen from this side, and then they are seen for what they are, which is failed attempts by the greatest of the greatest of human minds, failed attempts to say something true, to bring some true vision of reality to the human arena and to human suffering and misery. All failed attempts. Beautiful, gorgeous, wondrous, but failed attempts. All that works is reality. So I'm actually tickled to hear this. I must be doing something kind of right. Thank you, Brett.
Yes, and take it from another tough case. In my case, I'm another in that category. It is working. It is working. And in fact, all the lookings that occur throughout my day are stringing together in such a beautiful way that the not looking times are just they don't have any energy. You know, it's okay. It's totally okay. And I'm just so happy to remember to look. And then that happiness sort of expands out into a general happiness that connects to the next looking. And again, the non-looking moments are softer and on and on and on. And so I'm sure many people in this Sangha here are can agree with my report. It's exactly working. It's exactly working.
Hallelujah. Thank you, Brett. I'm again, very happy. This is, this is what I live for. So please stay in touch with me. Let me know how you're doing, and maybe we'll talk again someday soon. See you.
Sure, sure. Thank you very much, and I hope to speak again.
Okay, anybody else?
Michelle, calling from Vancouver, Canada.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Hi, John. How are you? I'm doing well. I was sick for a while, but I'm feeling much better now.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. I'm happy the sick is over with and you're feeling much better now. Can I do anything for you? It's good to hear your voice.
John, when I first met you, the first day I met you and I heard you talk in the public satsang, and you talked about being here, and I remember coming forward and saying, you know, I haven't felt this kind of peace, this unspeakable peace that I felt with you ever before. And then I asked you a couple of questions, and at that time, I knew without a shadow of doubt my search was over. But it was one thing that you said that really tipped me over was, in this, you're on your own, all alone in this. I can help you, I can point you in that direction, but you're on your own. And when I was listening to you talk just now, and every time I hear you, you say the same thing but in different ways. And I think the reason why I overlooked it is because it was so obvious that it's overlooked. So I just wanted to thank you for that, for saying that I was on my own, because every time I listen to someone else or I've asked for enlightenment or was seeking enlightenment, I always felt that someone would lead me there or someone would take me there or point me there and I would see it. And you did point me, but I had to do it on my own. So could you please say something on that?
This is without seeing this, nothing is possible. Without seeing that you are absolutely on your own, that it is totally up to you, and you know, it's okay if you, not you, Michelle, but because it wouldn't be okay with me if you did this, but it's okay if one decides that, or if one just chooses to stay in the game, to stay in the game of misery and suffering and fearfulness and anxiety. That's okay too, but because it is true, or at least it was true for me, that until I saw that there's no one to help me, there's nobody can do this for me, there's nobody that can bestow upon me peace and fulfillment, that there's nothing whatsoever that anybody can do except show me what to look for, or I don't know exactly how, except what Ramana did. Because, and by the way, Ramana's instructions are very much spiritually incorrect, I might add. But without this hearing that you must do it yourself, that everything I say, all of the work that I do, all of the persuasion or the persuasiveness or lack of persuasiveness, the skill or the lack of skill that I bring to this job is beside the point if you don't see that you got to do it. You know, you don't see that you actually have to do it. The understanding of it is not it. The understanding of the efficacy and the value and the power of self-inquiry, that's not it. The understanding of what is to be expected and how it is that self-inquiry works to bring an end to suffering and fearfulness and anxiety, that's not it. It's not any of that. It is what you must do for yourself. It's like if you want a well, if you want a well that goes to fresh water, you have to dig the hole. You can't think about the hole. You can't hope that somebody bestows upon you a hole. You can't, I guess you could hire somebody, but you have to dig the hole. The metaphor breaks down there. But you, in the inquiry, you must dig the hole yourself. Nobody's going to do it for you. Nobody can do it for you. Nobody can make the hole appear. Nobody can... You have to do it yourself. And it's more than just doing it yourself, Michelle. It's doing it. You have to do it. It's, you know, you follow that? You have to do it. And you, obviously, you do follow it since you've been doing it ever since. But yes, that's critical. Two things. First of all, understand the step-by-step process. Step one, try with all your heart to see the reality of what you are. Don't worry about the distractions and the thoughts and the ideas and the understandings and all of that that will vie for your attention, all the distractions that will vie for your attention. Whenever you can, whenever it occurs to you to do so, try with all your heart to see the reality of what you are. That's step one. There is no step two. And know, while doing that, that you have to do it. You actually have to do it. If you persuade yourself on spiritual grounds that it, like it can't be done, like something I was reading here today, or cannot be, that what I am cannot be known by any process, that you can't be, do it, you know these things on spiritual grounds, that will, well, that'll prevent you from doing it. You have to do it. You have got to do the practice. You have got to try with all your heart to see the reality of what you are, and nobody can do it for you. Do you follow that? Is that okay? Have I said enough?
Yes, I follow that. You've said exactly what I wanted to hear. And I also wanted to share this with others in the satsang today because it made such a huge difference for me. Thank you, John. I love you.
Thank you, Michelle. I love you, too. Anybody else?
Vietcom, calling from South Carolina.
Hi, Vietcom. How are you? What can I do for you?
Okay, I just heard what Brett was saying, and I thought it was absolutely great, absolutely so magnificently said what I really would know how to express, but it was so great about the way you talk about your one-step inquiry, or whatever it's called, one-step dance. It's absolutely magnificent to me, and I do not know anybody else that talks in the same way. And I would like to say thank you very, very much for the way you have to talk about this. And also, I would like to say thank you very, very much, Carla, for all your background work.
Yes, everybody should thank Carla. The truth is that nothing whatsoever, that none of the good that comes from any of this work is possible without Carla. Carla actually does it all. I just kind of talk. Carla does it all. Carla is a miracle, and everybody should know that. And I'm grateful to you, Vietcom, for giving me the opportunity to say that here in public. So you're very welcome, and it's wonderful to hear from you, and I hope all is well in South Carolina and there's not tornadoes and stuff that are chasing you around. Give my love to Carly as well. Thank you, Vietcom.
Thank you very much, John. Yes, she's next to me, and she's well, and we don't have tornado at that point. So all is well. But thank you very, very much, you and Carla, for your magnificent work.
You're very welcome. Okay, one more, maybe?
Anna Harris, calling from New Zealand.
Anna Harris, hi.
Hi, John. Oh, John, this is an awesome satsang. It's just beautiful. Thank you to everybody that's speaking. It's so rich for me. I just can't tell you. But what I want to speak about is something that kind of feels like it's been hooking me up in the inquiry over a bit of time. And I think, you know, it's slowly working itself out, but I'd love it to hear you speak a bit about this. It seems that, you know, the belief that I am this life is slowly getting less of a grip. But the one thing that does kind of hook me is this kind of idea that I'm still going to get something from relationship. And I know there's probably not a problem with that and just to keep looking. But, yeah, it'd be nice to hear something about that.
These things that, these desires and yearnings and so forth that have for most of our lives stood in for the, what, for, you know, by that I mean that have taken the place of the, of that which is this only source of fulfillment. These things like relationship and love relationships and old children and understanding and all of the truly rich aspects of human existence. These things, there's nothing wrong with them. The desire for a love relationship is natural to the human form. It is part of the genetic structure of the human form, only with the stories told about it that makes it a cut above the genetics of it. There's nothing wrong with it. There is nothing wrong with pursuing it even. The problem with these things and the fact that yearning can be distracting from the inquiry, well, that's just the way it is, and it is not in the long run going to do you any harm, because as you have seen, because you said so, that you just proceed with the inquiry anyway, that the purpose of the inquiry, the purpose of the seeking after self, is not to rid yourself of the yearning for a love relationship. The yearning for a love relationship as the answer to the what seems to be the false promise of human life, the yearning after anything that will fulfill the promise of human life is to be expected, and it can be distracting, but it can't hurt you. You continue whenever you can, whenever it occurs to you, with that, this effort to see what you are actually, what you are in reality. And everything will be taken care of in the end. Now, the problem with these things, you see, is not that there's a kind of an innocent yearning for a love relationship. That's not a problem. The problem is the connection of that yearning to the desire for fulfillment in your life. And the reason that connection is made, the connection between, for example, the yearning for a love relationship or the yearning for children or any other thing, the reason that is becomes connected with the search for fulfillment in the life is because of the conviction that there's nothing to you but the life and the desperate effort that ensues from that conviction to find something that kind of answers the emptiness, that answers the agony and the torment, the anxiety and the falling short. Now, nothing whatsoever can be done about that connection, about that linking up of yearnings for this and yearnings for that and yearnings for the other thing and the healing of the life and making it fulfilled and complete and satisfactory. nothing can be done about that aspect of it. There's no possible way for you to talk yourself out of that. The inquiry itself, as you have reported, is gradually eating away the reason that that linkage between the yearning and fulfillment is made in the first place. That's all that can be done about that. The yearning itself either will find fulfillment or it won't. The yearning itself is not a problem. There's nothing about the life that's a problem. The only thing that's the problem is the conviction that there's nothing to me but the life, and that there's no hope for me but the satisfaction of this yearning. So what I'm saying is that the distraction that results from the effort to rid yourself or to do something about this yearning, to make it go away, to wish it wasn't there, to see it as a problem, the distraction that comes from those efforts is much bigger than the distraction of the yearning itself, which just comes, takes you for a while, and then drops you off. Wherever it drops you off, there you are, absolutely capable of trying with all your heart once again to see what you are. So that's the main thing I'm saying. It's not the yearnings that's the problem. There's nothing in the life that's the problem. Not even the following of the yearning is a problem. You just continue with what you're doing. And what you have already noticed, which is a loosening of this undercurrent of conviction that there's nothing to you but this, you've already seen that that's happening. That will continue to go, continue to happen. You will come to a point where you don't even notice that it's not there anymore. And then see whether the yearning needs to have anything done with it or not. Then see whether the yearning is even still there. In my case, things turned out pretty well in that regard. But only after the finishing of the idea that this is what was going to save me, that this is what's going to bring fulfillment and satisfaction. And that never can be done away with by any direct means at all. That can only be done away with by doing away with the cause of it. Do you follow me?
Yeah, I do. That's great. I think the thing in my mind that kind of conflicts a little bit is I've been watching At the End of Europe a couple of times lately. I absolutely love it. And in that you speak about, you know, that nothing actually works. And so I feel like there's this real deep knowing that nothing actually works. And so I've got this set up around relationship. And so that when that yearning's there, it's like, well, that's not going to work anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true. And that's a useful thing to say to yourself, but it's not necessary. You see, even the belief that it's going to work isn't going to hurt you. At this point, at this juncture, since the inquiry has been proceeding for some time, I don't think there's anything you can do to derail it or to make it ineffective. So, once again, it's useful. It can be useful for you to remind yourself of the fact that a relationship isn't going to work either, but that doesn't mean that that's going to make the yearning for a relationship go away. And the effort to make it go away, or the effort to talk yourself out of it, is equally a distraction as the yearning is to the effort to see the reality of what you are. Not in order that you can be done with the yearning for relationship, just to see the reality of what you are, just to rid yourself of all belief about what you are in the light of reality. And so it can't hurt you to remind yourself that nothing you've tried before has worked. Can't hurt you, can't do much good. Just keep up the investigation. Just keep up the seeking after reality, and all will be well. Do you follow that?
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's brilliant. Thanks, John. Thanks, Carla.
You're very welcome. Yeah, you know, this business about what we think we know what stands in the way of fulfillment. And when we hear this teaching, since this teaching goes straight to the heart, it really goes to the heart of the matter. I don't mean the heart, you know, in a spiritual sense. I mean it goes to the core of the matter, the heart of the matter. Since this teaching does go to the heart of the matter, it is received, it is often received, and there is an impulse to want to protect it and to do something about the things that stand in its way. But nothing stands in its way. Nothing. If you make the effort, this is infallible. It takes time. It's long time for some, short time for others. But all begin to notice the effects of it pretty quickly. So you're doing a wonderful job, and I'm really happy to hear from you. I'm really happy to hear from everybody. Okay. I am told that there are two more people, and then I'm going to run away from you. Okay? Okay, who's first?
John French, calling from New Zealand.
John, hello. How are you? What can I do for you?
I'm feeling new to this. I found out about you about a week ago, and I've been looking at your site for some time, and just quite amazed at what I've learnt. I guess from a very young age, I have always wondered what the answer. There was this unanswered question I've been aware of since a very young age. It's plagued me since a boy, and no one could sufficiently answer that question for me. I looked externally, I guess, all the time, under every rock. I turned over every stone. There was this great unanswered question inside me that I couldn't satisfy. I've been looking and looking. Now, my relationship, 15 years, came to an end about 6 months ago, and I moved out and moved into a very modest camper van and took very few possessions with me, and I decided that this was probably the best idea. To give away all these ideas that possessions will bring happiness, which they didn't, and also that relationships, I've had three, which have failed, and I guess I expected my partner to give me the answer and the final the satisfaction to this happiness I've been seeking. It was Anna Hera, actually, who was just talking, who put me on to the end of my rope, and I watched that about 5 days ago, and I watched it twice, and I was up all night. And I guess that describes me. I am at the end of my rope, having looked all my life, and then realised that nothing I'd done has worked. Nothing that I've tried to satisfy through all my possessions and relationships has worked. So now I'm living a very, very simple existence and thinking if I was sort of like a semi-surrender situation where I've given away everything hoping to find amongst nature the answer. And your End of the Rope video spoke volumes to me. It woke me up. I've been aware of a self that's been there. It's almost like an instinct that there was something else. I've searched everywhere else externally, and then it occurred to me that there is this self, and all week I have been saying, I. Who said that? I. Who said that? And this has been what's been going over and over in my mind continually for the last few days. I feel like I've struck on something very important. I guess I've been the last 5 years, in terms of a relationship, you could describe it as cohabitating in solitary confinement, I guess. And so I've really come to the end of my rope. And the question I have for you is this instinct I have when I heard or watched and the stuff that I've been seeing off your site, which I have been reading with great interest, there's an instinct that I have that this is right. This is the path for me, and this is the answer I have been searching. I feel like my life for this last 50 years has been like a jigsaw puzzle which is complete with one piece missing. Have you ever done a jigsaw puzzle and you can't find the last piece? The picture's incomplete. And I feel like that piece has been missing all my life and I've never been able to find it or satisfy it. I've got a feeling, an instinct, that I have found it through your teachings. And I've yet to find out a lot more, of course. But I was going to ask you about instinct. Who or whom is that instinct? Where is that instinct from? I've always trusted it in the past. What is instinct? So I just want to thank you, John, and Carla, of course, and also Anna here for introducing me to all of this. And just wondering whether I should be continuing. It's just really about instinct. What do you say about that?
Well, you know, this is great news, John. Many of the things you say really kind of are the thing about saying I. I'm very familiar with that. That was one of the first ways in which I tried to enact this inquiry. Once I really got it, what Ramana was offering, that it didn't have anything to do with all the things that people said about Ramana, that it was much simpler and to the point than that, I walked around the prison saying, I. And so I'm familiar with that, and it's delightful to hear that this is, that this particular thing has come to you too, this particular method has come to you too, spontaneously. As to instinct, here's the thing about instinct. Instinct is an experience. There is a feeling that arises that something is right. Now, in the case of the feeling that is instinct, this is quite subtle and quite nuanced, and feels like something special apart from everything else. And in fact, the sense that you've hit upon something generally is right, not always, but generally is right. But it's not its rightness or its wrongness that is of any consequence. It is you that are of consequence. You being the one who feels the instinct, who relates to, responds to, accepts or rejects this sense of rightness about something, or even the sense of wrongness about something that we refer to as instinct. But the thing to see is that instinct itself is fundamentally no different from any other rising conditional experience within the human mind. It is something that, you know, and there's been lots of discussion about how and from whence things arise, and lots of discussions about karma and cause and effect and conditional arising and all of that. But all of that's beside the point, because instinct is fundamentally no different from any other experience that arises. It's different. Its difference is a difference of quality rather than a difference of fundamental reality. So, I said all that to say that when this experience of instinct is present, the experiencer of instinct is also present. And the inclination always, and it's not, you know, it's not like, oh, this is a wrong thing. It's just the inclination that arises from the same forces and the same conditions that the whole apparatus takes form to serve. This experience of instinct is the invitation for you, in the subtlety and the sweetness of that feeling, to see if you cannot find the one who has this instinct, the one who feels this instinct, the one who is experiencing this feeling of rightness. Because it's not the feeling of rightness that we're after. It's the reality that we're after. the feeling of rightness, the feeling of wrongness. In all cases, there's someone who's feeling that. And the possibility always is to look and see if you cannot find something that feels like an entity for that has this instinct. If you will do that, you will find, I pretty much can bet, that there is something that feels like that, and when you bring your attention to it, you'll find that it kind of vanishes. It's not the vanishing of it that we're after, however. It is the fact that as that experience of the one who has the instinct vanishes under the light of attention, it allows the light of awareness to enter the apparatus itself, just for a second, which is another way of enacting the inquiry. The inquiry, the seeking after self, the seeking after reality, is anything whatsoever that brings about this face-to-face contact with the light of reality and allows it to flood the apparatus and over time remove this conviction that there's nothing to you but there's life and that there's nothing for you to take your understanding from but instinct or knowledge or any other thing whatsoever. It is so that's what I have to say about instinct. Instinct is an experience. In the presence of an experience, there is always an experiencer. In the searching after the experiencer will disappear, and what remains is reality. You won't see anything, you won't know anything, but it is that opening of the structure of the personality to the light of reality that does all the work. Do you follow that?
Yes, I understand that beautifully said, John. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And please keep in touch with me by email or something. I may, I'm very bad at answering emails, but I love to hear from you and others that I've spoken with about how things are going. So please stay in touch with me, and maybe we'll talk again at another meeting. Thank you, John.
I certainly will do that. Thank you, John.
Okay, one more, right?
Now we have Rose, and we don't know where she's calling from.
Hi, Rose. Is this you?
Yes, this is me calling from Chicago.
Well, welcome. I'm happy to hear you. What can I do for you?
Yeah, I had a couple of questions, maybe even three quick ones. What do you think about just asking the question, what is aware? Like if you're hearing something or noticing something or whatever, and then asking, and what is aware of that? Does that make sense?
Here's the thing. Anything whatsoever, here's the thing, Rose. Anything whatsoever that serves the purpose of bringing you in contact with reality works. And if it's a question, if the question is what is aware, and then the further question, what is aware of that, actually has the effect of moving your conscious attention to inward, if it is the same thing as looking for the reality of what you are, then it's fine. There's no particular formulaic construction that can be said to be good or bad, useful or useless. It's only in the doing that it reveals itself to be useful or not useful. Do you follow that?
Yes. From what you know, do you think those would be useful questions that would lead the same place?
They can. I mean, anything can lead there pretty much. They can. But I can't answer that question. I can tell you what I did. I can speak about what I did and so forth. And And I suppose that that sounds like a question that I may have asked in the course of the whole business of this work. And I can tell you other things that I've done, but I generally don't do that because the only one who can know is you. The only one who can do it is you. And it is, you have got to rely on your own natural intelligence and common sense to direct you in this. So, again, yes, that question can be very useful or not, and it just depends on whether it's useful to you, whether it has the effect that we're after, which is to bring attention inward to the source of attention. Okay?
Yes, thank you very much. And then what do you think about, because I think you mentioned that there's almost like two eyes, but anyways, what do you think of the idea of following the breath and on the in-breath, mainly staying with the sensation of the breath, but maybe a very gentle I, and then on the out-breath, M, but primarily sensing the breath in the body?
The practice of mindfulness meditation, which involves watching the breath, the practice of mindfulness meditation, as I said, which involves watching the breath, it often involves counting the breath on one, either the in-breath or the out-breath. That practice of mindfulness meditation can be very useful in the inquiry, in the sense that the cultivation of mindfulness itself develops the skill that's needed to be effective at directing attention, and the skill that's needed to be able to recognize the natural discernment that's present in you that is able to discern what is and what is not, whether I am actually seeking the direct contact with reality, or I am seeking like the correction of the individual apparatus and so forth. The practice of mindfulness meditation can cultivate skillfulness in those ways. I don't know that linking, again, some formulaic questioning of that involves the invocation of the I am divided between the two breaths. I don't know whether or not that will be effective in bringing your attention face to face with reality. And again, the only one that can know that is you. If in your own natural intelligence and discernment and common sense, if you have the sense that that actually is having the effect of bringing attention to reality, then it's good. Anything whatsoever can be a distraction or can be a useful ally. The same practice. Someone could sit and watch the breath and with great intent and determination and purpose intone I on the in-breath and M on the out-breath and do nothing at all except have some peaceful time with the mind kind of stilled and directed in a non-aggressive form. Or the same, exact same practice, the exact same set of circumstances could sink the attention of the mind directly into the reality of what you are. It's my sense that if you are doing mindfulness meditation, and if you are therefore on the, I don't remember which breath, but on the in-breath intoning I, and on the out-breath intoning M, you would be better served during that, looking to see if you can find the one who is seeing all that, who is aware of all that. But again, you're the best judge of what works. The only instruction is to try with every ounce of energy and seriousness of intent that you can muster to bring yourself face to face with reality. If what you just described is doing that, then it's fine. And if it's not, it's still fine. It's just not serving the inquiry directly. Do you hear me?
Yeah. When I do it, and I just started doing it more recently, so I just wanted your input very much on if this was something. But when I do the I am, maybe this is just mine, but I do it to kind of remind myself of the thing that never changes, that like as no matter what I'm doing on the outside or walking through my day, the reason I do it is to remember that I am, that I exist or whatever, or that thing that, and again, maybe this is just the mind and it's, you know, and I'm misusing it, but the reason I do it is to try and remember the thing that doesn't ever change. But is that just the mind or is that the right track if I'm using it in that way?
Well, everything at all, the whole show is the mind. The reality itself is not anything that's subject to objectification. So everything whatsoever is mind. The question, understand something, Rose. I think that anything that is done that brings a measure of peacefulness and quietude to the feverish human mind is a good thing. I don't have any problem with any of it, really. But my question is not whether or not this is useful or whether it's mind or whether it's this or that or the other thing, but my question is who's doing this? And not so much what is the reason for doing it, but who has this reason for doing it? That goes to the heart of the matter. Who's doing this? And given that the reason is to remind one of what doesn't change, who is it that's seeking that reminder? Who is it that's seeking that pause in the feverishness of mental activity? Who is it that's seeking that distinction between reality and the mind? Because from my point of view, I see nothing whatsoever to distinguish between anything. So the question then, the question of the inquiry is, who's doing this? Really, who's doing this? Where do I find the one who's doing this? And where do I find the one who has seen that that this has this good effect on things? Okay?
Yeah, that's real helpful. And then last quick question is that, do we have time for that?
Sure.
Tomorrow, for example, and this is just an example, there's a party that I might go to, but I really would rather almost stay home and just try to find the self or listen to one of your satsangs or focus more on this, because I feel like until that's the most important thing, and I feel like the party, more than likely I'll be just distracted and, you know, waste a few hours and come home tired. And then is there validity in that thinking? What's your opinion on that?
My opinion on that is that you don't have anything to say about whether you go to that party or not. That you can certainly, you know, have an internal conversation about whether it's good or bad or better or not better, but that in the end, there's nothing you have to say about it anyway. You know, I am often reminded of in conversations like this, of Ramana's advice to his mother when his mother was harping on him and begging him to come back home and take care of the family and be a good son and do the right thing and so forth and so on. And Ramana pointed out to her very gently and very without compromise that no matter what you think you should be doing, no matter what you think you want to happen, whatever will happen, will happen. If you think you should not go to that party and that it is a waste of your time and that it is a distraction and so forth, the fact that you think that has nothing to do with whether you end up at that party or don't end up at that party. If you are to be there, you will be there. If you are to stay home, you will stay home. So that's my actual opinion about it. And what I see also very clearly is that it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter what the circumstances you are in. The inquiry, the investigation, the seeking after reality is absolutely within your power anywhere, in any circumstance, in any company, in the midst of any distraction. And the inquiry itself takes just a second. In the midst of the noisy party, in the midst of all of the pushing and pulling that take place in a social setting, in the midst of all of that, you are still here. You will not be absent. There is no way in the world that you will be divided from yourself, and you will always and forever, no matter where you are, no matter what's happening, you are able to stop for 1 second and look and see if it is not true that you are here, that you are unchanged, that you are the same as always. And the point of looking at that is not to persuade you that that is the case, but because as it happens, looking at that brings the receiver, that is your attention, in connection with the light of reality. So wherever you go, look for yourself. Look. See if you cannot find what you are. Not find out what you are, but see if you cannot get the direct, immediate, face-to-face contact with yourself. Whether you're at the party, or you're sitting in a darkened room, or you're on a meditation cushion. That's all beside the point. Is that okay?
Yes. Do you think there's value in taking like a whole day on a Saturday or a Sunday and just being quiet and sort of focusing more time on it? Do you think that has any value?
Well, I would be foolish if I said it doesn't, since I spent so much time in solitude doing it myself. But for me, as for you, I didn't have any choice in that. That was something that was given to me without regard to my preference, which, of course, my preference in those days would have been to be outside socializing and getting high and so forth. But, Rose, if you find yourself at home, use that time. If you have time when you can just sit quietly and focus directly on this investigation and on the seeing with mindfulness the arising of distraction and the falling away of distraction and all of that, then do so. It will certainly do you much good. But doing the inquiry in a social setting will also do you much good. The key thing is to do the work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is that helpful, Rose?
Yes, and thank you very much. That was very helpful. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Okay, we're going to go now. Please, I don't have much to say because I've been talking an awful lot for the last 2 hours, but when I do stop talking, please stay around because Carla has something very important to tell you. I don't know what it is, but she just held up a sign to me. But please stay around. Carla really needs to talk to you. And all I really have to say to you all is I'm just speechless at how much your presence here confirms what I have known for such a long time about the essential simple power of the possibility of being finished with all efforts to find satisfaction and fulfillment in understanding, in relationship, in knowledge, in, I don't know, in any other thing that has to do with fixing your life. The power, the possibility of being finished with the idea that fulfillment is available to you through fixing your life, and to be open to the possibility that fulfillment is already here, and all that's required of you is that you look to see what is here, what you are, what reality is, that you look with every ounce of earnestness and energy that you can muster without regard to the spiritual problems that may arise as a result of taking this path, without regard to the spiritual incorrectness of it all, the willingness that is represented by your presence here and your presence everywhere we go, and the wonder of what we have seen about the actual effect of this teaching in the lives of the people who have been with us, is sweet beyond belief. You are all the encouragement in the world. You are the confirmation of reality. I am so happy to be with you in this. I am so pleased to see you here. I'm very happy with everything that we talked about today. Please stay in touch with me. Please let me know how you're doing and what you're doing. And I will be seeing you everywhere. It's so hard to say goodbye. Goodbye. See you next time. I love you all.